Saints, deductive, activis, anarchy, artis, disco, copy, astronaut, axis, disease, radio, cunty.
Thank you everybody for still staying with us to the second panel. My name is Brigitta Isabella and I'm part of Kunci. I will moderate the second panel, which titled Onlooking. And I will keep my introduction to the panel really short because, of course, we hope that we will have more time to discuss during the Q&A session since we were a bit late in the first session. So, on this panel, Onlooking, after we had the first panel titled On Listening, we also wanted to address kind of in a similar inquiries in a way of sensing by using the methods of looking, and we want to explore different layers of looking, such as the gaze, which is the researcher's gaze, as well the archival gaze, also the vision, the eye, and also the tools such as the camera, the microscope, the written text. And here we already have three speakers with us. We have Wim Manuhutu, we have Pamela Patinama and Paul Bill. I will tell a bit about them, their short bio when they come. But briefly, what will happen in this panel, Wim will speak about room views, a very peculiar scientist who is actually blind, and he will explore the he will use room views and his from his archives to think about how to decolonize this kind of scientific knowledge which was produced by him. And we will also, secondly, we will have Pamela Patinama, who will deals with postcolonial archives, mostly containing family photographs and snapshots, to think that as tools of self-fashioning and suggesting how Indo-Europeans negotiated a politics of difference as opposed to a politics of imitation and reputation. And lastly, we will have Paul Bill, who will speak about perhaps vision as another aspect of looking. Well, he will talk about the ideas of human equality and human rights, which are often framed as Western, but he will also look engaging with Indonesian Dutch colonial archives from another perspective, perhaps decolonization as a perspective and methods to draw attention to the continuum thinking in terms of inequality in both countries through processes of, among others, racializations, gendering, and sexualization. So we will start with Wim Manuhutu. Wim Manuhutu was trained as a historian at Utrecht University, and he from 1987 to 2009, he was one of the directors of the Molucca Museum in Utrecht. Now he is an independent researcher and curator at Manuhutu, and his interests include Indonesian and post-colonial Dutch history, diversity in Netherlands, and issues of race. At present, he is working on a PhD thesis on the cultural relations between Netherlands, Suriname, and Indonesia after 1945. So, Wim? Ah, there are you. We can start with you now.
Thank you. Thank you for this this kind introduction. And I was actually making some pictures, so I was looking at you while you were introducing the panel. Remfius was here, literally. He is here in this very building, in more ways than one. And what I want to do in this very short presentation is actually to bring out the fact that we need to know more about Remfius in order to take him apart in a good way. Obviously, to decolonize our perception of Remfius and the way that he worked in his day and age, and the way that his legacy is still with us. So if we go to the Tropenmuseum in Oostvaart, we will encounter Rumphius, the mannequin of Rumphius, in the very beginning of the exhibition, as he represents that part of the Dutch encounter. And of course, it's always very dangerous to talk in terms of encounters, because it has the tendency to basically wipe out all the nasty parts of encounter when you talk just about encounter and engagement and things in terms like that. But in this section of the exhibition, of course, Rumphius represents basically the gathering, the production of knowledge about Asia, and in this case, particular part of Asia, the eastern part of the Indonesian archipelago, the Moluccas, Ambon, the blind seer of Ambon, that was his nickname, the blinde seer from Ambon, and it was in the subtitle of, you see, the front of this this etching was used for a small book that was published in the beginning, actually, of World War II, and it was titled The Blinde Seer from Ambon. On the left, we see the Rumphius commemorative coin, a boat, a ship by the Royal Dutch, not the Navy, but the company that that serviced the islands in colonial Indonesia, was called the Rumphius. And then we have a plaque also commemorating Rumphius. And the commemoration of Rumphius has been a part of what makes Rumphius so extraordinary. In scientific circles, botanists, biologists, maritime biologists, Rumphius is a household name as being one of the first who studied marine life, in general, in Ambon and its surroundings. And the fact that he became blind basically adds to the fascination of many who have engaged with Rumphius in the past. And we see that reflected in all these beautiful publications, the Ambonse Rariteitenkamer. Late Professor Beekman made it his life work, basically, to study Rumphius and publish all his works and translate them into English. And this is what always happens. He was at odds with the other person, the late Mr. Bouze, who also made it his life work to basically know everything about Rumphius. And what they did was to focus on Rumphius, the scientist. But if you look at Rumphius, obviously, he started out as a soldier, later becoming a merchant, and then later on becoming the scientist who became world famous. So the knowledge that he gathered and produced was gathered and produced in the colonial situation, where in Ambon, Rumphius arrived after decades of war in order to establish the monopoly on spices, that according to Dutch historian Gerrit Knaap, who is a specialist in Ambon in the 17th century, had as a result that one third of the population of Ambon and the surrounding islands had perished, either directly through war or through famines or otherwise. So the knowledge that Rumphius has gathered is not innocent. And that is, by and large, by many people who deal with Rumphius, well, they make this reference to the fact that, of course, he was a VOC employee, but the violence that surrounds the production of knowledge of Rumphius is often left out of the story. And it is the focus is on the personal tragedy of Rumphius losing his wife and his daughters after an earthquake, losing the manuscripts that were sent to Europe. So there's enough drama in the life of Rumphius without, it seems, many people have thought, going into the drama that was happening in the Moluccas. If you look at the works that deal with Rumphius, obviously you see this recurring pattern where Rumphius is highlighted, but all his assistants remain in the shadows. These are the people who drew after he got blind, the people who helped him, the people who gathered the information. These people remain nameless and faceless. And of course, being in, located in the 17th century, also the explanations by Rumphius sometimes reflect 17th century science rather than modern science. Nevertheless, he is still considered to be one of the forerunners of biology, of botany in Indonesia. And he was famous in his lifetime. He wrote with all kinds of scholars in Europe, and after he passed away, a monument, which is in the right lower corner of this page from the early 19th century, was already erected in Ambon. And we see here in the 30s of the 20th century, colonial officers paying tribute, homage to Rumphius being the great scholar he is. So that is the sustaining power of Rumphius. Even to this very day, and even though parts of the monument have been replaced by modern-day Indonesian plaquettes reproducing the text that was on the original monument, the monument is still there in the city of Ambon. You can actually go there and see it. The nice thing, though, is that it also is a monument that is slowly crumbling. You see on the left a photograph when the monument was still pretty well looked after, and then on the in the middle, a photograph I took a couple of weeks ago, and there was actually a garbage bin in front of the monument. I took it away, or we took it away, because it would be too easy to photograph the monument with the garbage bin as a sign of, well, look at how things are being kept here in present day Ambon. We have a Rumphius library, an enormous archive of knowledge, basically in Dutch, so inaccessible to a lot of people who live in Ambon now. And it basically reflects the fact that a lot of the knowledge that was produced by Rumphius and others like him is there, it's inaccessible, and by being inaccessible, it becomes a sort of a magical power. What Rumphius has stated is true, because we have no means to really understand and to contextualize the knowledge that Rumphius gathered and others like him. So in Ambon, to many young people also, Rumphius is a magic name. You have the Rumphius community that has over 1,600 members, the majority being located in Indonesia, and they are very much interested in Rumphius, even in his silsila, in his family tree. One could imagine, I'm a young person in Ambon, why would I care about the silsila of a German in the 17th century? But this is the power of Rumphius. What I do think is extremely important is to not only read against the archival grain, but read along the archival grain, as Lorenz Stoller has said. We need to study, we need to know what Rumphius and others like him who produced knowledge in a colonial context produced. We need to know Dutch, to learn Dutch as Indonesians, as Ambonese in this case, in order to be able to critically reflect on what Rumphius has said. Now, people sometimes come to me and ask, Pa Wim, they're very deferential, they're younger, so they would say, Pa Wim, we have these texts by Rumphius, could you help us translating? Of course, anything more than 4 pages becomes a problem because time is always limited. But it is, I think, very important for them to have direct access to the archives, so then it's basically one of the ways to pull away the curtain and expose Rumphius for who he is, not as a fraud, but as a person who is located in a certain colonial situation, and his knowledge is situated. And what we need to do is to basically deconstruct Rumphius in order to appreciate him better, but in a more modern, post-colonial way. And I think this museum, any scientific institution in the Netherlands, has a role to play in order not only to give access, but to actually facilitate researchers and to engage with researchers in a critical way in order to do so and to take this next step in decolonizing the archives. Thanks.
Thank you, Wim. I think you made a really good point about language and accessibility. We can also discuss about that later, but now I want to introduce our next panelist. Her name is Pamela Patinama. Pamela is Emeritus Professor of Postcolonial Literature and Culture at the University of Amsterdam. Her publications include essays on the representation of mixed race in Dutch postcolonial films and literature, and the relation between memory and identity formation. She participated in the PhotoCollect project on colonial legacy and museums in contemporary European history, and her book, Bittersweet is Indies, Memory and Nostalgia in Literature, Photographs and Films, was published by Prometheus Bertdokter Amsterdam in 2014. So, Pamela, please.
Thank you, Gita. I would like to begin my talk with this family photograph. It was made in late colonial Indonesia, then called the Dutch East Indies, of course. And it was used on the cover of a recent book containing the memoirs of the late well-known Dutch historian Kees Vasseur. He was born in the Indies and died last year. Now, Vasseur is portrayed here as an angelic little figure, together with his babu, or nanny, a local Indonesian woman. The memoir of Vasseur covers many topics, but contains not a single reference to this woman. So why has this snapshot been used on the cover? As a family photograph, it was part of a family familiar genre, and as such, the publishers must have thought it would appeal emotionally to potential buyers of the book. But this commercial reason is supplemented by an ideological one. Time and again, similar sweet photographs pop up in the Netherlands in public space and strongly suggest close ties between black and white, white and brown, colonizers and colonized. They keep the beloved narrative of racial harmony during the colonial past alive. This image evokes the colonial past as a time to be remembered with nostalgic fondness. That the ultimate cliché image of an harmonious colonial past contains a white child and a subordinate dark woman is, of course, telling. It asks, in any case, of viewers to forget complicated matters such as exploitation, unequal power relations, racism for one nostalgic moment. So our Dutch colonial archives are filled with such images of late colonial Indonesia. They circulate widely in the Netherlands and are often, too often, used as evocations of colonial nostalgia. So my ongoing project, A Bittersweet India, I wrote this book, but it's an ongoing project, deals with the recycling of cultural memories of the colonial past. It urges me to use the archive in an attempt to go beyond the so familiar nostalgic gaze, to find ways to look differently at colonial photographs. My starting points have been the material and pictorial turn and the social life of things introduced by anthropologist Arjun Pederai and picked up by curator Elizabeth Edwards, with whom I worked together in the photo project. Now, Edwards argues that photographs are social actors with an active life rather than merely passive images that represent a fixed and true history. Following her, I consider photographs as performative objects that serve many roles in daily life. My assumption is that all pictures are performed and determined by the context in which they occur can always be seen as public presentations of the person portrayed. I use, therefore, performance as an analytic tool that provides a perspective for framing photographs. In my research, I focus on a special archive of family photographs, the so-called EWI collection. And this archive includes more than 60,000 photographs which were taken in late colonial Indonesia, shipped to the Netherlands, and brought together in a collection by Indies migrants themselves. Now, EWI stands for Indies Wetenschappelijk Instituut, Indies Scientific Institute, a name which actually mocks claims to scientific knowledge of official institutionalized archives. The collection consists consists mainly of amateur snapshots capturing the everyday life of Indo-European families, that is, families of mixed Indonesian and European descent. And on these pictures, we see family members posing inside the house, in lush gardens, leaning against modern possessions, with friends on outings, playing with dogs. So all these pictures were made during the first half of the 20th century, during a very turbulent time of transition. It was the period of the so-called ethical movement, the ethical policy, a time of nation building, violent expansion, and the implementation of modern technologies, civilization, and European bourgeois values. Due to the prevailing discourses on desired civilization and skin color, the social standing of Indo-European people was rapidly decreasing. In sharp contrast to French or British colonialism, the Dutch encouraged interracial unions in the colony, mainly for economic reasons. For centuries, European men and Asian women, called nyais, had lived together unmarried and had mixed race children. And these, what Enstola has called domestic arrangements, were the normal standard households in the Indies. Around 1900, racial mixing became, however, a taboo, and mixed race came to be seen as far inferior to full-blood whiteness and full-blood Asianness. Indo-Europeans were confronted with objectifying negative and inferior images of themselves in official and literary discourses. It became, in short, necessary for Indo-Europeans to invent and fashion new identities. This against the prevailing images of themselves as second-rate citizens. Interestingly, rather than written texts, they used the camera to represent themselves and counter such degrading portrayals. Now, Marion Hirsch has rightly observed that during the 20th century, the camera has become the family's primary instrument of self-knowledge and self-representation. In fact, for Indo-Europeans in the colony, photographs were often the only autobiographical material they possessed. Only a few written documents exist which may serve as Indo-European self-representations. So that is why I came to use family photographs as performative, to explore how Indo-Europeans negotiated with prevailing views on sexuality, race, and civilization in their everyday lives and aspiration. Let's have a look at the next photograph. So this is one of the family photographs stored in the EB archive. What you see is a visibly mixed family, a white father, Indonesian mother, and kids in darker and lighter shades of pale. It's especially obvious that the brown kid on the left in the front is his white father's offspring. Both have the same sticking out ears. And this family must have gone to a professional photographer to record them and to be remembered mixed as they are. Now the next picture is a portrait of an Indo-European family taken in about 1908. A frail old Indonesian woman is seated in the front row, both in the center of the family and in the center of the image. The back of the chair seems to form a crown or halo around her head, whilst the bodies of all the younger women seem to bend slightly towards her. The older woman, whom we can presume must have been a nyai, obviously has an honored place at the heart of this Indo-European family. This may not seem very special, but it is remarkable as such an image is in great contrast to dominant discourses which regard nyais, so Asian-born women living together with the white men, as the main source of white degeneration. In fact, an overwhelming amount of literature written by white authors portrayed the nyai as an evil figure and a dangerous embodiment of exotic, sleazy sexuality. So what firstly can be gathered from these photographs is that unions between white and brown were a reality which was not hidden as a social taboo. Secondly, in contrast to the overwhelming amount of representations of evil nyais in official discourses and in literature, in everyday photographs, Indonesian foremothers are presented as the pivotal and honored figures which they must have been in mixed families. Now, this peculiar photograph shows how Indo-Europeans did participate in the desired modern middle class lifestyle that was aspired. I'm not sure why this picture is taken, but I assume that it may have been taken to celebrate the installation of the toilet. So this woman proudly poses next to this modern procession. Tea drinking in the garden in the afternoon, visible for everybody who passes by, was also one of these Dutch middle class values. Here you see such a model set up of a neat white nuclear family properly drinking tea together in the garden. And you may recognize the daughter, Ella Huysen. Very famous Dutch writer about the Indies. So in the second photograph, a mixed race family's casual but also confident style of self-representation is shown. Family members are having tea and snacks in a disorderly part of a garden, washing lines in the background. No trouble is taken to imitate neat bourgeois style of self-presentation. They drink tea in the garden, but there's no sign of a teapot. They wave their forks, and cups and saucers have been put down quite randomly on a much too small side table. Note the older Indonesian grandmother. Because of the photographer's viewpoint, the gaze of the viewer is drawn to the plate in the foreground, on which a few snacks wrapped in pisang leaves remain. This image suggests that Indo-European families apparently did not mind having themselves pictured quite distinct from the style favored by elite European families. It confirms that they did participate in the bourgeois ritual of drinking tea in the garden, but the emphasis is much more on a typical Indo-European custom, the sharing of snacks, called snoepen. So all photographs that I showed suggest that Indo-European families consciously or unconsciously fashioned themselves by negotiating an alternative way of belonging and difference against the shameful image that they met in institutionalized documents written during the first half of the 20th century. The families participated in the rituals. The families participated in rituals that expressed modernity, civilization, and wealth, such as having toilets and cars and drinking tea in the garden. At the same time, they respected their descent from Indonesian foremothers and held on to their own traditions. They, in other words, self-consciously presented themselves to counter the inferior and racist views regarding mixed race identity included in such lifestyles. Well, so my study of the performative quality of these Indo-European photographs is defined, among others, by Frantz Fanon's term, decolonizing self-ownership. And I link this to what Michel Desserteau's point, everyday tactics, which refers to the way ordinary people reappropriate and change laws and regulations in everyday situations for their own purposes. To look at family photographs as early selfies or self-representations, as I do, makes it possible to use photographs as an alternative source to the documents about Indo-Europeans written from above. In the Netherlands, many colonial images I looked at through an all-too-familiar nostalgic gaze. Hence, difficult matters such as exploitations, unequal power relations, and racism are obliterated. And as Paul Bell has argued, the references to colonial violence and atrocities which pop up every now and then continuously do not interfere with this ever-present persistent nostalgia. So the violence and the atrocity are of course an unfinished business in the Netherlands. So I think it's important that by looking at photographs as performative, such complicated matters can still be explored in a productive way. And I end this talk by this small Indo-European boy negotiating his own place, however small.
So after we heard briefly from Wim about the eye of this blind German scientist, and we heard about the gaze of snapshots, the gaze and the performance of snapshots photographs by Indo-European family, we now have our last speaker, Paul Bill, who will speak about the vision of Indonesian human rights thinkers and how they. By reading archives of their thoughts, we might find another frame of thinking, human equality and human rights. So Paul Bill is a scholar of comparative literature and has written about postcolonial memory and forgetting, photography of colonial atrocity and colonial human rights history, as Pamela has mentioned before as well. And his monograph is called Emerging Memory, Photographs of Colonial Atrocity in Dutch Cultural Remembrance, which was published in 2015. And he is now currently preparing an edited volume about transnational appropriations of the Javanese author Kartini, and a monograph on Indonesian human rights thought in the colonial period. So, Wim? Sorry, Paolo.
No, no, no. Okay, thanks everybody. Thanks to Kunshi and the Research Center for Material Culture for this invitation. And the honor to be in one panel with Pamela and Wim. The talk is going to be a number of responses to and reflections on some of the themes for this symposium on the website of Kunshi. And what I want to work towards is, so I'm writing about Indonesians during the colonial period, writing about their legal and their legal and social position in colonial society. And I'm still looking for a way to conceptualize this. And one idea I'm currently working on is this: is the idea of citizenship as insurrection. And this comes from French philosopher Etienne Balibar. And I hope to offer it to you here today. Of course, we will see Indonesians during the colonial period were not citizens, but I will explain this later. But also for us as Indonesian and Dutch citizenship, to think of it as possibly a form of insurrection. And I hope that some of the Indonesian authors I am studying will be sources of inspiration for us. Now, in one of the documents for this symposium, it is stated that what Kunshi is doing here is, and I quote, research and publicly discuss the Dutch East Indies collection of the Token Museum, reflecting on the multiple afterlives of colonialism, archival language, and the politics of memory, taking the museum as a starting point. Now, as a scholar of literature, reading this, I am immediately reminded of the dismantling of the museum, or maybe the institute's library, only a few years ago. And I was wondering, I wanted to ask Kunshi, did you still come across a lot of books here? Do they still have books here in the museum, or are they all gone? For instance, I was wondering, does the museum have a copy of Buiten het Gareel by Giorgio Puspitaal? No.
Is it
Keitel V? Yes. So that I kind of. So I think you were very right in bringing Suwasi Giorgio Puspitaal back in the audio guide, because she was taken out a few years ago. I'm sure that the Institute had a copy, or I didn't check, but I would be very surprised if they didn't. Anyway, the books went out a few years ago, so we can't read here anymore. And of course, I'm exaggerating, there will be other texts. However, I think it's precisely books, as well as other texts written by Indonesians, which formed the main part of my research project. And in my research project, I, as Brigitta said, I have more or less two at the moment. I look at how these Indonesian authors act as if they were citizens. That's how I'm trying to conceptualize it now. And on the other hand, a specific project on Kartini and her transnational circulation, or the transnational circulation of her writings in the past 1.5 centuries. Now, when we hear the term ethnographic objects, I think we, first of all, at least I don't think of texts initially. You know, manuscripts, books, journals, newspapers. Rather, the texts you associate with ethnography are maybe those written by the ethnographer. So in this case, that would be mostly Dutch people. Although Kartini also partly worked as an ethnographer, interestingly enough. This is not to say that there is no attention for Indonesian texts in scholarship across the world. And I think there are many studies of Bahasa Indonesia texts, but also Javanese and other texts by historians, anthropologists, literary scholars, etc. And also, the Netherlands has still a huge collection of these texts in Leiden, namely. Still, it is significant that the Museum of the Tropics in Amsterdam, one of the very few institutes in the Netherlands with Indonesian writing, had to give up its collection. And what does this forced abdication of the collection mean in the present Dutch context and for Kunshi's research project? Kunshi states, it aims to decolonize knowledge. Now, a few thoughts about this. First of all, to decolonize knowledge means a lot of different things, I would say, to a lot of different people. And if we don't see colonialism in a metaphorical sense, but in a historical sense, and think of the two countries, Indonesia and the Netherlands, already many different groups, and within these groups, many different individuals, for all these people, it has a different meaning. So in the Netherlands, you can think of different communities, white Dutch people, Indonesian Dutch, Surinamese Dutch, Caribbean Dutch, but also, for instance, Moroccan and Turkish-Dutch people have different relations to the colonial past, and within these groups, their relations are even more different. Processes of racialization, but also of gendering, are crucial here. And if you look at Indonesia, and I'm glad this was already addressed this morning or this afternoon by Kunshi, there are also many differences. Think of the position of Papua, Maluku, Aceh, or Chinese Indonesians. Moreover, colonialism and the colonial past are not the only challenges we face. And in a way, the legacy of colonialism is only one expression of what we could call the politics of exclusion. The radical limitation of citizenship in both the Netherlands and Indonesia, as well as the neoliberal project which reduces everything, including education, Kunshi's main interest, to economic calculation, cannot be reduced to colonialism, but form grave threats to both equality and liberty. Well, nevertheless, let us look for today, or for now, since this is our subject, at the legacy of colonialism. And I will return to the absence of books here in the museum. The disappearance of the books from the museum can be interpreted in many ways, but fits also a larger pattern in the Netherlands, where I think less and less writings of Indonesians addressing the colonial experience are available. In fact, during the colonial period and in the first decades after decolonization, the situation was somewhat better, I would say, due to Indonesian and Dutch publishers, authors, and other actors in the field of literary production seeing the value and importance of these books. And I will go into them a bit later, but these are some of the authors and books I'm working on. The first one has not yet been published. I will tell you about this later. These books were all, except for the first one, importantly published with the help of Dutch people, or co-published by Dutch people, although, of course, inflected in specific Dutch ways. Nevertheless, they were there. However, these texts at the moment are not in print. Kartini's most important letters were last printed 40 years ago in 1976 in Dutch. In English, they were published only a few years ago. Suwarsi's novel can only be bought secondhand. Even Pramudia's novels, of which many have been in last decades translated into Dutch, cannot presently be bought in a Dutch bookstore. Finally, the dozens of Indonesian novels on the colonial period published in English by Lontar Press in Jakarta in the last decade maybe, of these books, zero have entered the Dutch bookstores and, as far as I know, have never been discussed in the Dutch press. So the Dutch have virtually no sight of colonial Indonesian writing. A range of concepts can be employed to theorize what is happening here, but I think the most fruitful for me, and this goes back to my earlier project, are still of racialization and compartmentalization in the Netherlands, where certain histories and bodies are racialized as not belonging to the Dutch past and the Dutch experience, which is essentially seen as white, and then are compartmentalized and either silenced or periodically rediscovered in an act of surprise, which is at the same time a performance of innocence. Kunshi asks, among other things, what are the modes of study that we can utilize to better understand colonial pasts in the present? The way the question is put actually reminds me of two of the people, one person here and one person who I didn't put up here, Shahrir and Hatta, who both saw learning as essential to the Indonesian nationalist movement and also to the Indonesian people. Shahrir, influenced by European modernism as well as by Minangkabau ideas on Rantau, argued for a dynamic citizenship and a nation that is not static but changes as it goes along. Now, I was very happy that Kunshi picked up Suwarsi's novel. Just like Shahrir, she is one of the Indonesian authors who I study within a particular framework now formed by two French philosophers. One I already mentioned, Etienne Balibar, but the other is Jacques Rancière. And he has written that, it's a complicated phrase, I will explain it after I phrase it. He says that the rights of men are the rights of those who have not the rights they have, and who have the rights that they have not. Now, this is a paradox. First of all, we need to state again that Indonesians living in the colonial period were not citizens. They were subjects, imperial subjects to various legal systems. They had some rights, but they were essentially subjects. This subject status went hand in hand and was facilitated by a status as, and this is coarse to say, but non-humans or lesser humans. All of the writings I study attest to this experience. And to give just one example from Kartini's work, at one point she says, "The Dutch laugh at us and ridicule us for our ignorance, but when we try to educate ourselves, they adopt a defiant attitude towards us." Now, this experience is phrased by all the authors I have here on the PowerPoint. It's the deprecating attitude of the Dutch towards the Indonesians. Nevertheless, the authors I study in various ways and degrees defy the society they lived in, and despite not being citizens or even not being humans or considered as humans, acted as if they were. This is the meaning of Rancière's phrase. By acting as if they had rights, these authors, these Indonesians, protested a society in which they did not have them. Let me tell you a little bit about them. These are five important authors for the project I am working on now. The first is a man named Wange van Bali. He was enslaved as a young boy from the island of Flores, and eventually ended up in the Netherlands, where he learned Dutch and wrote his memoir. It has not been published yet, but we hope to publish it one day, also in English and Indonesian. He wrote in Dutch. Then follows Kartini, who, both inspired by and critical of European feminism, argued for rights for women and men in both European and colonial society. Sukarno, third here, who, following the example of Hatta, who I already mentioned, made a plea for Indonesian independence in a Dutch court when he was himself put on trial for his nationalist activities. Then Suharsi Dr. Puspito, who wrote a novel about the years in which she was active in the so-called wild schools, which existed outside European jurisdiction. And finally, Shahrir, also already mentioned, who imagined the new Indonesian nation state as fundamentally different from European colonialism, with equal rights for all citizens. Now, all these Indonesian writers, through their writings, protested the society which denied them many things: equality, liberty, humanity, and citizenship, most of all. Of course, today, in the space that was once formed by the Dutch Empire, the number of citizens has dramatically increased, especially in Indonesia. Still, as Rancière writes, it is not only that all citizens who are nominally sovereign do not have an equal share in the established power structure, and notably in the power to make decisions, but that from this point of view, there must also necessarily be those who are shareless, individuals and categories whose share is denied, and for whom chances to obey will always outnumber chances to take charge or take initiative, who are expected to be passive more often than active. The Indonesian authors here are, in the words of Etienne Balibar, offer a prefiguration of an egalitarian community of citizens. Of course, we know that neither in the Netherlands nor in Indonesia this egalitarian community has been fully realized. As Balibar writes, resistance and protest against the forms of determined domination or oppression always involve the emergence of construction of counter communities with their own modalities of exclusion and internal hierarchies. Therefore, Balibar argues to see citizenship as a project without an ending, and democracy following Derrida as always to come. Citizenship, Balibar holds, can only exist as an insurrection. It is a struggle for democracy that is at the same time an experience of democratic citizenship, an attempt to expand the spaces of liberty and equality. Effective political conflict involves an element of illegitimacy, and the Indonesian authors I study in this sense provide models for this. And I would also be interested in how Kunshi sees their activities as having an element of illegitimacy. These authors provide perfection? No. Kartini, I think, was an elitist thinker, for instance, and Sukarno's nationalism had strong ethnic overtones. Nevertheless, their acts of citizenship, so the moments where they acted as if they were citizens, as if they were human, as if they were equal, which were at that moment transgressive acts, Arbeit makes it important to read these authors for both Dutch and Indonesian citizens, as well as non-citizens, who are arguing for their rights to rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Maybe we can now have a 15-minute Q&A, so Paul and Wim, Pamela and Wim, please come to an essay. Not yet. Maybe we only have 10 minutes for Q&A, so anyone from the audience who wants to pose a question, please raise your hand. Anyone? If there's no one, I can also start.
Hello.
Okay. Yeah, anyone? Oh, okay. Please. Maybe you can also tell us your name first. Thank you.
I was curious, referring back to Carolyn Bertel's comment from the first panel, where the process of digitization was erasing some traces or somehow not digitized metadata of the original documents, how that might affect each of kind of the images or texts that were referred to in the different presentations.
The photographs that I study are digitalized, and this in these short presentations I did only a short stretch of my study. Because what I do is the traveling and the journey that the photographs make. I study that traveling and then look at the meaning which the photographs receive in the different contexts. And this archive is digitalized and is stored here in the Tropen Museum. And of course, a material photograph, a paper photograph, has a different emotional impact than a photograph that you see big on a screen, on a monitor, or here in a PowerPoint. And that's also one of the questions that you have to ask when you explore photographic archives.
Pamela, I have a very short question in relation to photographs, because usually in the colonial era photographs, there are also written text on the back,
yes.
And whether you also use that as material, part of this material,
yeah,
in your photographs.
Well, that's an interesting question, because there are all sorts of onderschrift, what's that in English?
Captions.
Captions, yes. Many of the photographs are put into albums, and in the context of an album, a photograph gets another meaning than when the photograph is loose, free, out of a context of an album. So everything that is written, everything that is making a context for these photographs adds to the meaning of the photograph, to the changing meaning, of course.
Mm-hmm. And they are in the process of digitalization, are they also?
Yes, yes, all the captions and everything that is written in underneath the photograph or at the back are being saved and stored.
Wim and Paul, do you have any comments on digitalization?
Well, actually, just to pick up on what Pamela said, the fact that you digitize, and of course these albums where photographs are put into specific places and in specific orders, you need to take that into account in order to get both the information but also the effect of the photographs. And this is one of the dangers of digitization, where you take these photographs out of context. But sometimes it does offer the opportunity for people to actually make up new albums. And this is what is happening, I see a lot, from Indonesia. The digitization as an effect has that young people basically search at the internet. Yeah. People are really tech savvy, and they take all these pictures and make new stories. Mm-hmm. And so that, for me, is also interesting. But yes, the digitization offers new possibilities, but also has these pitfalls of taking things out of context.
I have my thinking of the things I work on. It's mainly positive digitization, because these texts would otherwise be unreachable. So very brief.
I just wanted to say that Kunci actually reads the Manusia Bebas from PDF because it's available online.
Yeah.
Fortunately. Mm-hmm. okay, we have another question. Wade, please.
Yeah, this is both a comment and a question, and it really relates to Paul's presentation. Thank you, actually, excellent presentation. One of the things that I think is necessary in this project that we do is also to be careful, to be mindful of how we understand the institution. I think that a writing needs to be done on the dismantling of the Royal Tropical Institute, which is different from the Tropo Museum.
Okay.
So when you say books have disappeared, books were never in the Tropo Museum in the same way that you're talking about. There was a library that was a part of the Royal Tropical Institute. So one, I think that is an urgent study that needs to be done now, because it's still so fresh, that we understand what it meant to dismantle the institution and how does that relate to the different parts. So that's the first thing. Now, going to your project itself, though, I wonder if I understood you correctly, because are you suggesting two things? One, that the decolonial process, like citizenship, is always in the future. That it's always a labor that one needs to work at, which is future-oriented, that it is never settled. So is that what you're suggesting? Or what are you suggesting in relationship to the museum itself? Because in a way, I could also say that you are right that our representation, both of the Caribbean or Indonesia, has never really included much of the anti-colonial revolutionary histories that are a part of that. It is that has been not so much a part of the history that we've represented. So what are you suggesting in relationship to the museum itself?
Wayne, thank you for a complicated question. That's what you're here for. First of all, about your first comment, I realize that about the institution and the museum, that they are not the same. Did the library, did the museum ever have a library of its own, or is this not?
The museum had a library. We had a small library downstairs there.
It's still.
But I mean, we do have what is called the Hanbukarai, and the Hanbukarai is still a part of what we have here as a place that one can consult. Parts of the archives are here as well still. And some of it will move into a central documentation center for research that that would be for the, all four museums. But that, I think, is must be made separate from the closure of the library that was the case. So,
maybe I should frame it more broadly then. I think it's very meaningful that the absence and even the taking away of Indonesian writing in the Netherlands is now countered in a way by bringing an Indonesian author, or I should say a character from an Indonesian novel, here in the heart, to the heart of the museum. So from a bit of a broader perspective, there is I think it's very meaningful that this has been done. I think that citizenship is a work in progress, but decolonization should not be. Decolonization should have an end, indeed. And in that sense, I don't see them as at least I hope it will have an end. And talking about what this means for the museum, you asked, right? Well, I hope that the museum, but I know you are doing this, is a place where discussions about citizenship and decolonization can meet. And I think this is also one thing that, but I hope to, I'm also curious what Kunshi will say. Maybe Kunshi is also thinking about here, how a decolonization of the museum, if you look at it in a broader context, has to go together with the rethinking of citizenship in both the Netherlands and in Indonesia.
Well, before giving a pleasant time for Kunshi to answer, since after this we will also have a session for Kunshi and Ping, the curator of Netherlands, is in this exhibition to have a conversation. I want to also bring Wayne's question to Pamela and Wim, since in a way, Wim, your presentation about the dramatization of the personal life of Rumpius was also somehow resonate in the mannequin that we have in the Netherlands is in this exhibition. And at the same time, Pamela, if you see the, I believe you already see the exhibition there. There are actually precisely photographs of these happy and beautiful Dutch families in the exhibition room. And I wonder whether you as a researcher and also who might believe that we can rethink how museums should display this kind of objects and figures, how what kind of gesture should be made.
Thank you. Well, actually, it shows that permanent exhibitions are never permanent. They are a reflection of the discussion that was there in the beginning of the 21st century that in the end resulted in Oostvaarts, where the purpose was to have these mannequins reflect certain discussions, discourses on colonialism. What we see now, 12, 13 years later, is that in certain ways the discussion has developed and has moved forward. So perhaps it is time to say goodbye to Rumpius and to move to other persons and figures from colonial history. So for instance, if we would have a new exhibition on the Netherlands Indies and the transformation and the independence, why not feature August 17th as an important date to commemorate and to talk and think about in this museum, but also make the connection to the fact that August 17th is not only important in an Indonesian context, but it's also Tula Day, the commemoration of large uprising against Dutch colonial rule on the island of Curaçao. And so to make these connections between resisting colonial rule in the East and the West, and to look for new ways to connect also this museum with the monument in the Oosterpark that commemorates the abolishment of enslavement of people in the West. So new ways of looking at it.
I agree that I think that the expositions in museums should be temporarily, not permanent, because every time and every group brings a different perspective and a different meaning and gives a different meaning to the objects. Objects are, of course, not static, meaningful objects. They are given meanings. And what I think is important also is that not only official curators make expositions in museums, but also groups of people who live, well, in England they do that. They give the people who live around the museum the chance to make an exposition in the museum. That's great. And I think an exposition in a museum or wherever has, of course, a sort of function of giving information, but in the first place to raise questions about not only about the objects, but also about appearances and people. And I think 17th of August would be great to have a next exposition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pamela. It's really good to say that museums actually a place to raise questions, but unfortunately, due to time restraint, I have to say you cannot ask questions anymore now in the museum. But of course, you can do it later. And thank you for the three speakers here for the amazing presentation. We will
thank
now
you.
Continue to the next sessions. The last one. I hope you will stay with us so you can still ask questions. We'll have we will have Sarah Janini Nuning and Pim Westerkamp as the curator of the Netherlands East Indies permanent exhibition.
And Vicky
as well.
Scenes, deductive, activists, energy, artists, disco, copy, astronaut, axes, business, radio Kunsi.
The recording was created as part of Kunsi Research Residency at Trapan Museum under Heterotropics 2. Heterotropics is a long-term research and curatorial project initiated by Amsterdam-based curator Sarah Giannini and organized in collaboration with the art platform TAAK. Unfolding through different chapters and collaborations, it investigates the immaterial and material remnants of colonial desire in the city of Amsterdam. Heterotropics 2 is realized with the kind support of the Research Center for Material Culture, Amsterdam's Fonds for de Kunst, and Prins Bernhard Kulturfonds.